everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Language Lounge. My name is Michelle Ola, and I have Dr. Danya Mahoney here again. So we did an episode, and we talked about, so many things, right, Danya? So many things we talked about. But we were talking a lot about access and advocacy for all students to be able to have access and learn a second language. And so we did our episode on some kind of big picture ideas, right? So, you know, least restrictive access and advocating for all students to have access to languages and not be kind of gatekept, or I don't know if that's the right term for it, but to have equal access, and how we can really meet the needs of all of these learners, first of all, by getting them in our doors, right? Allowing them access to the World Language Classroom. And that it was really our big discussion from our last episode, just getting them in there. And so now what we're going to do is we're going to kind of take it a little bit farther. We might review some of the things that we talked about last time, some big picture ideas, but we're really going to really look at, okay, they're there and they are there, right? They are, they're all students, all diverse needs. All of those students are already in our classrooms. And so once they're there, what can we do as world language teachers to support them and make sure that they are successful, right? And that all of our students have that amazing opportunity to be able to learn a second language and to be part of this wonderful experience, right? So, Danya, why don't you just go ahead and tell us, why don't you just, in case somebody didn't listen to the last episode, just give us a brief little talk about, you know, who you are and, you know, kind of a synopsis, and then people can go back to the other episode if they want to know more.
Okay, so I am Danya Mahoney. I recently earned my doctorate in educational leadership, and my area of interest is that intersection of world language and special education. And as we talked about last time, I'm really passionate about making sure that every student has access, that we recognize that the least restrictive environment for a student in the classroom is the one with their peers, and that there's really no research that demonstrates that students with disabilities can't learn a language. What we do know is that students can learn a language when they're given the supports and the accommodations that they need to learn. And those accommodations and supports are not unique to one subject area most of the time. It crosses those core subject areas, and world language is a core subject. So we need to provide those supports. So there's some systemic issues, and that's something that I talked about a little bit last time. But we're seeing more and more that school, universities, and post-graduation, post-secondary situations are expecting students to have access to world language. And so now what do we do, right? For so many years, world language was that special course that was only for the students who didn't have learning disabilities. And now that we look at the situation from a civil rights perspective and recognize that learning a world language is not just, you know, a core subject in school, but it is a civil and human right. The UN talks about, the UNESCO has it listed amongst their human rights, that every person should have access to high quality language learning so that they can speak 2, 3 or more languages. So those are all reasons that we need to have our students in the room. Now the question is, what do you do when you have students that you've never worked with before and populations and diagnoses in your room that are just not familiar? And for many teachers who have taught other languages, it is challenging to work with students with disabilities, but often there is some training and experience. World language teachers in many cases are left out of that conversation because their districts maybe don't recognize world language as a core subject, or maybe the kind of tradition of exempting students from world language means that the world language teachers are also exempted from professional development opportunities. So those are all things that kind of that make supporting world language teachers in this transition to greater inclusion and greater access even more vital, because we have not historically been part of that inclusion process. So what do you
Absolutely.
Do, right?
Yeah, what do we do? And we talked a little bit on the last one about some things that, you know, education that we can do ourselves as, you know, educators to be able to learn more. I know something before we kind of hop into some strategies, because I have a feeling this is going to come up a lot or again, is tell me a little bit about UDL and how that supports learners and what that is, like what does the acronym mean and how does that some of those principles work? Because I do see that comes up quite a bit when we're talking about this topic.
So UDL, and it's actually something that I'm going to be speaking at the MAFLA board. I'm on the Massachusetts MAFLA board, which is the World Language Advocacy Organization for Professional Language Teachers in Massachusetts. And we host a variety of professional development opportunities. And I will be presenting a workshop on UDL for language teachers in the winter for our winter workshops. And those are remote for anybody who's interested in our, and from any time zone, if you're willing to be there. So what is UDL? UDL is Universal Design for Learning, and it is grounded in the same principle that says that, for example, if you're building a road and a sidewalk, you have a ramp, and that ramp supports and benefits those people who really need it, and it also benefits people that you wouldn't expect. So you may say, oh, I need a ramp for a wheelchair-bound person, or it benefits the bike rider, it benefits the person pushing a stroller, it benefits the person who happens to be on crutches for a little while. It benefits, you know, maybe a dog walker with 7 dogs who doesn't want to trip over the curb. So that little support that is built into the system is a way to benefit everybody. Even though its intended purpose was probably just to benefit one person or one disability, for example. So right. The idea here is that you are building into your structure accommodations and understandings that allow students to have better access, with the understanding that everybody needs some kind of supports. And so universal design is both thinking ahead about what you really want your students to be able to do and demonstrate, and also giving them choices of how they access that learning, how they engage with that learning, and how they express that learning. So there's really the three frameworks of universal design suggest that you should have multiple means of representation, right? How do they see it and how do they perceive it and how do they hear it and listen to it, look at it? Multiple means of action and expression, so like multiple ways to express and work with the learning, engage with the learning, visual. I mean, we used to talk about learning styles, and there's no such thing as learning styles per se, but you do want to have multimodal approaches, right? You want oral and kinesthetic and tactile and all of those different things, not because one person is auditory and one person is visual, but because we are all varying degrees of all of those strategies. And then we want to have multiple ways for students to demonstrate their understanding. So, for example, a very simple way to demonstrate this would be for in a classroom, you might have large posters up on the wall and ask students to demonstrate their understanding. One group might really gravitate towards a chart, right? Your three columns, what do I know? What do I need to know, right? Something very linear. Another group might want to visualize and create an image or a doodle or, you know, some kind of abstract visual that demonstrates their learning. Another group might benefit from coming up with a song to demonstrate their learning in music. So there doesn't have to be one singular way to demonstrate understanding with language. In fact, we do better with understanding language when we use these multiple means of expression. So that's kind of the background for UDL and kind of how it applies more directly to language learning.
Yeah, because I do think that is so important, because if you look at your class or your students that you have, if you're in high school and you have 150. I don't, you know, there's ridiculous amounts of students. And if you think about, well, I've got to individually, I have my lesson plan, and then I have to customize it for all of these different people, it seems impossible to do. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, you're like making things up on the fly, right? Whereas if you approach it from this UDL, this perspective of you're already customizing things based on students' needs and their preferences and how they learn and all of that, it's a lot less of a jump, I think, for me to then really get even more specific with individual, you know, learning, you know, differences, sort of a thing.
I think one of the things that, particularly if you've been teaching for a while, like I have been, it's been a few decades, you may have come across, you know, project-based learning was a big trend for a while. Differentiated instruction was a big trend for a while. And UDL is in many ways an evolution of these ideas, but instead of setting it up as the teacher creates, these are the only things that you can do to access language, you're providing options and multiple strategies, right? Think of, you know, maybe a bingo board of different types of activities that students can pick and choose from so that they can use their best skill set and demonstrate their learning most effectively. And you're not necessarily creating a unique and individualized approach for each individual student. You're providing, these are 5 or 10 ways that you could demonstrate your core concept, and maybe 10 may be too many, but like I picture a bingo board of, you know, 9 blocks, and these are the ways that you're going to demonstrate your learning. And they may need to include speaking and listening and reading and writing, but they'll have multiple choices of how they can access and demonstrate their learning. And setting that up in advance means that you're thinking it through from the beginning, and that at the heart of UDL is backward design, where you're starting from the very beginning to say, what is my end goal? So for those of you who've, I said, you've been around professional development for a while, with backward design, you're deciding what your end goal is, and then everything is structured around to create opportunities to get to that end goal.
Absolutely. I think those are just two very fundamental kind of places that we can, you know, we can kind of start and then move forward from there. So what are some other suggestions, tips, strategies specific to languages, maybe even some specific learning disabilities like dyslexia or, you know, dysgraphia or whatever, some other things, you know, where do you start?
So absolutely. It's like the what, so what moment here, right? So what exactly. Is it? And now, so what? So here's the thing. When you have students who come into your room, you will probably have access. You should have access to their IEP, to their 504 plan. And those are legal documents that you absolutely need to know. My wish would be that those students would not be cohorted or grouped together in large populations. However, I mean, we all know that that's a systemic challenge, right? But number one, you should know your student's IEP and 504, and you should really make sure that you understand how their individual needs will be impacted in the world language class. So for example, you have a student with dysgraphia. Well, dysgraphia makes it very difficult for them to write, but we also know from brain understanding of how the brain works, that kinesthetic experience of handwriting is a really important learning tool. So maybe you, and I just was working with a student yesterday, maybe you could have the student write, because that, and I think things that make it, it may seem counterintuitive, but like paper and pencil, the experience of dragging the pencil across the paper, right? That texture and the feeling of that on the hand, that builds the connections in the brain far more substantially than typing and using a typewriter. So having my student write while we were taking notes, but then me providing clarified notes, copied notes, typed notes, are all ways for us, for a student to build the learning, but also to ensure that they can refer back to it. Because sometimes students are like, well, this is not going to make sense to me later. I can't read it. You know, I think people who work with students with dysgraphia often say, oh, they should have a scribe. And I do think that that sometimes makes sense, especially in high stakes situations. But in the learning process, giving them the opportunity to write on paper and not grade them on the writing, just make sure that they're doing it for the learning process, is important. So dysgraphia is an interesting one because, and it's not as common as I think sometimes people imagine. I don't have the statistics in front of me, but it's not quite as common as you might think. Other things that you might, that a lot of us come across, I'm going to save dyslexia because that's a little bit of a special case. But so many of us are seeing students who are anxious or fearful about speaking. So what do we do? Well, agreeing to have smaller groups, right? Or having students working in centers so that there's only three or four students in a group, and then using that small group setting while the rest of the students are also being productive and hopefully working independently. But working in smaller groups can help ease anxiety. Also, purposeful pairings, right? Who's your partner? You want to gradually release the student from that experience in the sense that you want to, for a student to overcome, I'm not a psychologist, but for a student to become more confident in the classroom, they need to face some challenging situations and get better each time. But they get better when they're supported and scaffolded. So baby steps, right? So maybe today's anxiety strategy is you're going to say one word in the target language. Next week, we're going to aim for five words, a whole phrase, right? A noun and a verb. And maybe the next week, it'll be a sentence. But each time you're upping the level of complexity just a tiny bit, while also pointing out all those successes. You did so well. I'm so proud of you. You answered really well. So anxiety and, for example, selective mutism, that's something that I know teachers like, oh my goodness, I have a student who won't speak. Well, if you have a student who's already had that diagnosis, I guarantee you that person is seeing multiple therapeutics to help address that, because that's a pretty substantial disability in a high school these days or a middle school. If you have a student who is selectively mute, working with that team to just build up trust and faith that that student is going to acquire language is so much more important than holding them accountable to doing exactly the same thing. Working with students with disabilities is not about what's fair, right? And that's sometimes, I think, often you can see that visual, right, of the kids standing by the fence, watching the baseball game, and we talk about what's fair. Well, if he gets a box because he's only, you know, 4 feet tall, how come that's fair when, you know, the other kid's 5 feet tall? It's not about that. It's about making sure that students have the tools and the resources to demonstrate their understanding and to access the learning. And it's not about making it equal, right? It wouldn't be fair for me to have, I mean, would we question somebody wearing glasses or a hearing aid? And yet those are, you know, accommodations that we have built into our lives and our schedules and our teaching. These are just further supports that we can use to benefit all kids. For example, we know that if you have a student with hearing loss, you might have an FM system that you have to walk around with. And well, we know that that benefits all kids because it amplifies the sound around the room. We should have that in every classroom. We know that some people benefit from having closed captioning. I benefit. I watch television with closed captioning quite a bit because it just, I don't like it too loud in my house, mm-hmm. but I want to make sure. And, you know, sometimes there's a, you know, an accent I don't recognize. It helps. And so if what we're doing is providing those supports, maybe in our target language, we start in English or their first language with subtitles or captioning. And then maybe we gradually switch over to the target language and maybe, and each time you're making it more challenging. So it's an increasing amount of complexity so that students can see the words, hear the words, and engage with the words step by step. And that's all part of that pathway to proficiency.
I love that. What, you know what, I'm wondering if, because how do I say this? I don't think it's just students that kind of have that, but that's not fair attitude. I think sometimes we as teachers can also have that attitude. I know my son, I remember one time a teacher had like a choice board and she called me because she said, well, he's always picking the same one because that's the easiest for him. And I'm kind of like, well, isn't that the point of doing that? That's the one he really enjoys. Like he's a mathematical scientific person. So he always picks that way to show what he did, you know, but even though she had the choice board kind of felt like, well, this isn't fair because he's always picking the same type or whatever. But deeper than that, I think is that idea of especially young people that may not have had these conversations about equity and fairness and, you know, access and things like that. So you do teach a lot of languages. Do you talk to your students very directly about how you run your classroom and what fairness is and why something might look different depending on the circumstance? How do you do that? Do you do that explicitly or do they just kind of, you know, experience that?
So I think it's a little bit of explicit and implicit and behind the scenes. To come back to the choice board with your son, I think it's important that if you have a choice board that you want your students to do the thing that they're comfortable with, but also the thing that's hard, that being explicit about that expectation is important. And you can't just expect a student to choose the hard thing. That's a silly expectation. None of us choose the hard path unless there's some compelling reason. I mean, sometimes you'll find that student who's like, "Ooh, I enjoy a challenge." In which case they probably wouldn't choose the easy option and they might always choose that hard path, right? So I think just being explicit in your expectations. If I give you a choice board, you might need to do one thing from column A and one thing mm-hmm. from column B so that I know that you're touching on the more complex skills and you're not just demonstrating you're learning the same way every time. But to come back to the other question, I do try to address it very explicitly that everyone has different needs. I do find that my students kind of travel in packs a little bit, that sometimes scheduling keeps groups together. And I try to point out that every student has different needs. There is some of that still. I find that by the time they get to be a little bit older, they can start to recognize that what is necessary for them to be successful may be different than what is necessary for another student. And I also always, for example, if I'm doing just a flat out assessment, I always make two or three different versions of the assessment. One assessment might be just a straight up, you know, I'm not too much of a traditional quiz giver, but for the sake of example, one time it might be, you know, your standard traditional quiz. It will have visuals, it'll have models, because, you know, sometimes the students just misunderstand the directions, and using the target language to give directions may mean that your student doesn't understand the directions, but they can demonstrate their learning if they knew what they were supposed to do. So a model can be huge. So what I might do is have one model that's just, or one assessment that's just kind of straight up, but then another one will have a word bank, and another student might have, I might say to them, I saw you really practicing with that one study sheet that we had. You can use your study sheet on the quiz. And when I individualize that way and I say, well, you're going to create your own study sheet, that means that they're relying on their own understanding. They're not expecting me to provide that understanding for them, but they have to really master that. So it's going to depend a lot on the diagnosis and the individual kid, but it's likely that if I'm giving an assessment in my classroom, there's 3, 4, 5 different variations of the same content happening in the room. And so when students start to see that, I also always make my quizzes on separate pieces of paper. So say it's 4 pages for no good reason. It's just spaced out 4 pages. it's four separate pages, so I can give it to them page by page or section by section. And that way, nobody's really paying attention to the fact that Jimmy has three pages and Susie has five. And nobody pays attention because they're all stapling at the end. Everything, like, it's just so, it may sound chaotic. And it, sometimes it can be a little bit, but that takes away any sense of who everyone's looking at me or that embarrassment or she's right. singling me out. Everyone's getting some kind of support or accommodation so that they get what they need. And that's what I really try to emphasize. It's not about singling a student out. It's making sure they have what they need to be successful. I feel like
fantastic.
I have, I do want to, before I forget, no, I'm just talking. I'm talking.
Well, we go, I know I kind of derailed our original kind of path there for a minute.
I want to talk about executive function because I think that's so important. And that probably would be like one of the first things that people are like, what am I doing? And I think with executive function, that's just like, how do you organize your brain? How do you organize your the world around you, right? So having things like a word wall that is in the exact same place all the time, it can change for unit from unit to unit, but like it's always in that same corner. And then you refer to it. So it's not just that it's there, but that you point it out. Because there are kids who will be in your classroom every single day and be surprised that there's a word wall right next to them. So unless you point it out, they're not going to remember that. Some kids will be so they'll be so proud of themselves on the quiz. Like you see them peeking over and, you know, you leave it there on purpose because the students will refer to what they need and where they look. I sometimes teach Latin and I used to always keep, my declension charts on the wall. And those rare times when I'm specifically assessing declension, I'll cover it. And I'm so proud of them. And I always point it out when a student taking that test looks at the wall, because I know that they're looking and they're trying to create that visual in their mind and they're relying on the resources that they have. And that really supports them, right? So a word wall, being very consistent in your routines, starting the day with the same types of things, a question of the day or a bell ringer every single day. So that routine is in place. Clear schedules that are posted. I can't tell you how important an agenda is. I know that your administrators are probably saying, oh, please put your clear agenda with your, but really, if you say by the end of today, you will be able to talk about something you like, and that's clearly posted for the whole block, and then you have three tasks. That student who comes in late knows where they're going. That student who got into a fight with their boyfriend in the hallway and is just tuned out when you told them what to do gets themselves re-engaged and says, oh, right, okay, this is where we're going. And that empowers them. I don't want to say enables. It empowers them to take some control of that experience. So having a clear agenda that they can come back to and be like, oh, you know, I hate these listening activities. Oh, but we're about to do the thing I really like. You know, that kind of thing will allow them to engage with the learning and stay on track. It's kind of like having your own agenda in a meeting. Like, how much do we as adults hate going into a meeting and not yeah. knowing what the agenda is? Because then you're just like, oh, I just need to like get up and move around. Kids are exactly the same way. And
for sure.
having that ability to self-control the experience gives them a little bit of control in a life that's not very, that they don't have a lot of control over.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are really great points. Really great, just simple ideas. You know, I'm sitting there writing them down as you're saying them. So that's fantastic. Wonderful.
So the other thing is memorization. That's something like you can't learn a language without learning words. You have to know words. So what do we do when we have a student, for example, with slow processing or just has trouble with memorizing? Well, for slow processing, this may sound counterintuitive, but encouraging a student to do their homework with a timer. And what I mean by that is, like, say you want your student to learn 10 words and say, you know, here you're going to use flashcards. Just sticking with an old-fashioned routine for a minute. You're going to use flashcards, and I want you to make sure to count how many minutes, time how many minutes it takes you to really feel confident with these 10 words. Once they understand what that time looks like, it's much easier for them to say the next time, oh, that took me 20 minutes. Next time, I'm going to give myself 20 minutes. I'm going to focus on those 20 minutes. But teaching them what 20 minutes feels and looks like is an important step towards their having the autonomy to learn the language themselves or to complete a task, right? Just in everyday life, if your child has trouble with time and processing, asking them, how long does it take to get dressed? And then making them aware of what that time frame is, they can start to work with that in their own way of looking at the world. And then it gives them that independence. So they're not relying on you, right? If you're the parent who's always saying, like, how come it's taking you so long to get dressed? Maybe you need to make sure that they are figuring out how long they need to get dressed and then use that for them to control their time frame. So that's one strategy. Also limiting some distractions, which is so hard to do. If kids are trying to memorize, but they're listening to music, I have found, and like you mentioned that I've studied several languages. So I lived in Spain for a while, and I found it really challenging to study Spanish and to learn my Spanish when my roommate was watching an American television show, because I was switching, you know, it was just distracting to have English in the background while I'm trying to study Spanish. Making sure that you're listening to music without words, it's like a simple strategy. If you need music to help you stay focused, then just try to listen to something that doesn't have words, whatever helps you stay focused. But trying not to listen to things in multiple languages when you're trying to focus on one is a useful strategy. And also, when you're thinking about memorization, you want to use multimodal approaches. So there's some research around like color coding and all of that. And some of that's useful and some of it's not so valid. But I do find that if students are really struggling and you need them to know their parts of speech, making flashcards with different colored pens and then being consistent, it's always that consistency. So if your nouns are always red, your verbs are always green, if they are always learning their vocabulary words with that same routine, and they don't have to get different pens, they could use different colored index cards, or they could have different color highlighters that just speeds the process. That kind of color coding can help sort the information in their brain. Another thing with that is that making it multimodal can be super silly, but moving, right? Moving around and doing things. So one really powerful way, especially if you have a sequence to learn, is to have them either visualize or actually go to a place that they know. And each time they're in a new spot, so say they're walking around their house and they're in the kitchen, you know, each time they're going to say a word. And it doesn't have to be connected to the kitchen. It can just be, you know, like maybe it's, you know, cup, but maybe it's, you know, duck. But then you imagine a duck in the sink and you're learning the word duck and you're picturing a duck in the sink. You're creating the vision, you're creating it. And very familiar place. It's so important that it's not some random place, because then when they're taking the assessment or they're in a spot where they need to retrieve that word, they can kind of mentally get back to that spot and be like, oh, I was in the kitchen. I was thinking about a duck. Oh, it's duck, right? So you can start to attach meaning to things that are maybe not so meaningful. This is very silly, but when I was in eighth grade, we had to memorize the periodic table. And I'm not a scientist, obviously. I'm a language person and linguist, but not a scientist. But at the time, I had to remember that lead was Pb. Now, as a Latin student, I know that lead comes from plumbum and Pb is right. From plumbum.
Now it makes sense.
But when I was in eighth grade, for those of you who can experience my age here. There was a brand of peanut butter called Superman. Superman peanut butter. I'm not even sure why, or maybe I'm totally making it up, but I think I'm pretty sure it was Superman peanut butter. Superman can't see through lead. Peanut butter is PB. Lead is PB. I created this silly mnemonic with a friend of mine, and I still remember it. I'm not even sure I remember the peanut butter, but I certainly remember that lead is PB.
Yeah.
Sometimes the most silly things are the things that help us remember. And building up that connection of personal meaning, right? Nobody else may remember lead is PB from Superman peanut butter, but except for my friend Anne Marie, who studied with me in eighth grade. But but the things that click and make sense to us as individuals are the things that help us learn. And so I can't tell my students the one way to learn, because they have to figure out how to learn on their own with all of these supports in place.
That's fantastic. Since we're talking about memorizing, one of the things I also, besides like everyone, like you said, multimodal, different approaches to actually learning it, how about just choosing the words that you acquire as well as the amount? Because I think that's always, you know, again, if you're still thinking about when I learned a language, it was very much a list of 30 words, and every one of those words were equally as important because I had to know every single one, right? Whether or not I ever used them, cared about them, had any personal experience, whatever. You know, so it's, I think it's much easier now in a proficiency, you know, focused kind of classroom. But what is the role of both the quantity of the vocabulary and some accommodations or some, you know, ways that you might be able to help students work with their, you know, how they learn best, both in that quality of what they choose and the quantity?
So I think there's a couple different things that you can do. That's perfect timing because I did this today in my class, but we're doing AR verbs in my Spanish class. And I have a list of 30 words. That's a lot of words for anyone. So what I did was I highlighted my top 15. I gave everybody all 30 words, but I said, if you're only going to be able to focus on 15, focus on these 15. Are you going to need these other words in life if you're speaking Spanish? Absolutely. But let's start with, these are some foundational skills. Now, say I'm teaching Latin and I have a fairly complex, I have a story that I want the students to read. I can choose as I write my story or as I produce my story to, you know, put the essential words in bold. You can get the subject, verb, object in bold. Then I can put in regular font those supporting words, the subordinate clauses, for example, or a relative clause. And then all of the complex things that are additional and supportive, but maybe a little bit on the ancillary side, I could put in italics. So these are not things that require very special, you know, printing or anything like that. But what I'm doing is I'm saying, okay, your core information is in bold. The basic information that really makes the sentence come together, that's going to be in regular font. And the things that really make it interesting, engaging, and complex are in italics. And everyone can have that. Right. And so that's the universal design part. I've created it once and everyone has access to it. And if you say, you know, I really want you to be able to tell me who's doing the action and what is the action, you know, you can focus on one student to do that. Whereas another student, you might say, well, what's the relative clause or who's being referred to in that subordinate clause or however you want to talk about it? I'm using grammatical terms more than so I don't have a story in my mind, but you know, how do you refer to these things in ways that you can support the students who are with you in every single way, and also keep all of the students engaged with developing the learning? If my outcome is that I want students to be able to use AR verbs, I don't need them to know 100 of them, but I do need them to use a few of them really, really well.
That's awesome.
And also repetition. Act it out, model it out, keep it moving, right? We're going to be playing charades tomorrow. Little do they know. But keep it moving, giving them opportunities to use the language over and over and over again.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So many good ideas. Do you have any others like that you for sure want to do? And I know you did want to say it's something about dyslexia in particular, which I think was always a challenging one for me as well, because it is very specific, but it also looks very different in different people, it seems. But before we move on to that, was there any other really big tips or strategies? You've shared so many, but were there any others you wanted to make sure you get in?
I think one thing is just recognizing that students benefit from being with people they trust and feel confident with. So building those relationships, trying to really connect with students, get to know their interests, using chat mats, or if, for example, I travel between rooms. So having a word wall is tricky for me because I'm in several different classrooms, but giving students kind of a portable word wall, essentially a bookmark or a table triangle tent thing that they can reference and refer to, and then reminding them that that's something that they can do. Those are all strategies to put the words in front of them. So if a student understands a concept but can't retrieve the word, but they have the word on a paper in front of them, they can demonstrate their understanding. It doesn't mean that they're not learning the language. They just may be learning it or acquiring it in a slightly different way. So giving them all of these supports, it's not cheating, right? It's not giving them an unfair advantage. Mm-hmm. It gives them actually an advantage, but it gives them the opportunity to be successful in the way that their brain and their abilities require, right? And I try to avoid using disability because that really is that focus on dis, right? But it's what their abilities need.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, I always think if you withhold that scaffold or that support they need, they're never going to have that opportunity to acquire it, right? So, I think having access to that and trusting that they're going to use, that they know what they need, and they're going to use the tools that they need to be able to access that and to show what they are able to do.
Exactly. So, and we're staying with their age group peers is so important for their confidence, their motivation, their engagement. So making sure that students are getting support all the way through, they may not advance to the highest levels, but maybe they will. And if students aren't even given an opportunity to try, you'll never know if that's the area that they will be the most successful with. It is interesting. Dyslexia, I've done some additional studies in a dyslexia program. And I think dyslexia is really interesting because it's all about just how does the brain connect written language to spoken language. Our brain is wired for communication, but it is not wired for writing. And so when a student really struggles with that, and there's a disconnect between the written language and the spoken language, that's really where it's so complex and unique to students. But the things that are really foundational for like an Orton-Gillingham approach or really science of reading support for language learning really require it to be sequential. So very purposefully sequenced, very explicit, really a strong foundation in phonemic awareness. So really being clear about what the letters are and what they look like and how they sound and being explicit. So it's not just like, I don't know, when you're a little kid, you might say like, be, ba, ball. That ba actually kind of confuses a student in how they approach it. And when you see somebody teaching the letter B in using the science of reading as a foundation, it's buh, buh. There's no extra air, right? So giving them a chance, using a mirror. Sometimes I have students who have trouble processing, and I'll have them look at my mouth and then look at their own mouth in a mirror so they can see like, oh, not ah, but oh, ooh, right? So they're seeing the expression. And I just realized that we're going to be on a podcast that's audio, so you're not seeing my silly faces. But using a mirror to demonstrate that, it could be really helpful.
That's great. That is so interesting. Fantastic.
So well, yeah, with dyslexia, you want it to be sequential. You want it to be purposeful. You want it to be multimodal. So walking around, talking. I have some picture frames that I picked up at Michael's, and I one side has sandpaper and the other side has some kind of like fake fleece or something. And so if I'm really with a student who's struggling, they can handwrite, finger write the tips of their fingers, and they're writing on a surface that helps them connect kinesthetically, physically to the writing. And that you can do that in any language, right? Write the word on the fuzzy texture or the rough texture, whatever it is. And if a student's having trouble with the rough texture, give them the fuzzy texture or that kind of thing where they can physically manipulate the words and the language. That's a really strong starting point. I think if we don't allow students with dyslexia to take a language because it's too difficult, I feel like it's a disadvantage to them. And for example, Spanish is a much more straightforward language orthographically. English, mm-hmm. we've got 26 letters and 44 sounds. Mm-hmm. Spanish has 24 letters, 28 letters. I always get my numbers confused. Yeah. But it's basically, I think, 28 letters and 30 sounds. So yes, does dyslexia occur in Spanish? Yes. Does dyslexia occur in every language? To my knowledge, yes. There's some really interesting research out there about particularly, some of the symbolic languages like Mandarin and students with dyslexia in Mandarin, but maybe not so much in English and vice versa. I think that's super interesting and worth digging into. But I think we could also really support students with dyslexia in their first language by supporting them in a second language and really making it explicit and purposeful, consistent, sequential, multimodal, all those things that are just good practice for everybody, but really benefit students with dyslexia and language-based learning disabilities.
I also think it brings us back to our last conversation, the last podcast, in the fact just there are supports within your school. There are supports that you can, don't be afraid. In other words, because I think I was terrified mostly because not of the student, but of doing the wrong thing, not doing enough, not doing the right thing, right? But we have to also look at ourselves as we're learning about these different, you know, experiences, these diverse ways that students learn. And so, you know, reaching out within your school or, you know, professional learning that, you know, if you have a student that has a specific, you know, learning disability that you might not know what it is or how to do it. You know, there are resources out there and not to, you know, go back to what we said before, the answer is not to not provide access, right?
Exactly.
we have to figure out a way to move beyond that, to make sure that they do have the opportunities to experience, you know, we all love what we do. We want, you know, students to love languages and all of the benefits that come from that. And so not let our own kind of anxiety, I'm going to speak for myself, not to let my own anxiety about not knowing what to do, not doing the right thing, stop us from doing the right thing, right? So
exactly. And I think that's one place where just collaborating with the resources, for example, if you're fortunate enough to have a co-teacher or a paraprofessional, that person does not need to know the target language. What they do need to know is what best supports individual students. So if you have a student with executive function challenges or they have trouble initiating, well, that support staff could just be there to help get them going, make sure they have the pencil and that they know even where to start. If a student has trouble initiating, maybe give them sentence starters and then the support staff can just say, oh, look, there's a sentence starter for you. And that could be enough to get them started on the task so that everybody is getting supported and engaging and not just waiting for the teacher. It shouldn't just be the teacher running that, right? And I cannot say enough how important it is to advocate and work with those, with the special educators and the support staff to say, you know, Google Translate is not going to help them learn to use language. It might be a shortcut, but it's not going to help them learn. So let's not use that strategy, but let's use the strategies that we work on in class with a word wall or with familiar strategies. And because especially if a student doesn't really, they want to be successful, but they're not quite sure where to start, it is very tempting to start with a shortcut. Mm-hmm. But starting with a shortcut that doesn't help them learn is actually going to set them backwards. So sometimes I actually will model that, right? I'll throw something into Google Translate and I'll show the students how it turns out, right? Or maybe you put a paragraph from the beginning of Harry Potter or something into Google Translate and then you switch it between languages a couple of times and then bring it back to English. And the students will be so surprised when they see how terrible it is, especially if it's something they recognize really well, how the multiple translations make the original source maybe familiar, but not coherent.
Right. It's not coherent. It's not, right. Right, yeah. Absolutely.
So all of that, like these are just ways to build that community and really work with parents. Parents know their kids really, mm-hmm. really well, but also parents want their kids to be really successful. And sometimes learning a language is challenging. So the question is, how can you encourage them to support their child through a difficult experience and help them see that it can be fun, it can be engaging, it's not just work, 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 but it's a really vital life skill. And sometimes parents might resist having their student in language because they're afraid that their student won't be able to rise to the occasion. But giving them an opportunity with all the supports in place can absolutely give them a chance to rise to the occasion and find something that they love.
I love that. Okay, so here's my next big question for you. I don't know that I've ever seen, is there a resource that really does blend this expertise that you have with special education and world languages? When are you going to write the book is what I'm going to ask, because what I love about our conversation is that I've been to PD on, you know, a lot of things having to do with student learning and all of that, but it never spoke my language of language acquisition and all of these sort of nuances. So I'm kind of joking, but I'm kind of not. Are there resources out there that really do address this in the language of language acquisition that you know of?
So I come at this from the perspective of both a research-driven doctor of education, but also a public educator. So within that framework, I really reference some state materials. In Massachusetts, we just got new world language frameworks in 2021, which maybe isn't just, but the previous frameworks from 1999 were not that great. And part of that is that there were reference guides for various areas of learning. So for example, Massachusetts has a quick reference guide for world language learning for students with disabilities.
Oh,
It's only 2 pages and it's very straightforward, has a lovely graph of like, if you need trouble with routine, here are some ideas. The state of Delaware has a lovely document that they produced it, but the state of Delaware has a document that is entirely written for supporting students with disabilities. I have it somewhere on my desk here. And then the state of Virginia has had 2 documents that they've published, one as recently as 2020, where they have model lessons in multiple languages. So there's a lesson in Latin and in French and German. So each state that is really rising to the occasion right now, I'm seeing that there are multiple handbooks, if you will, 20, okay. 30, 40 pages that offer models and examples of what you can do to support students with disabilities. I mentioned these 3 states just because I know I've worked with those mm-hmm. materials, but I would not be surprised if Ohio, if Georgia, there's so many
some
states.
Some of the strong states, yeah.
Exactly. Iowa right now has some really great comprehensible input resources. Minnesota, Wisconsin, there's some really great programs across the country that are really working to advance proficiency in supporting students with language learning. And the need to support students with disabilities on that path is becoming increasingly clear and important across the country. So, have I written the book yet? No.
Okay.
Would I like to write the book? Yes, but
okay,
I'm not.
When you,
well, I don't have when enough you, time yet in my life, but I would like
to. When you do, you're going to come back here on the Language Lounge first, and we'll talk about the book when you get that eventually. But in the meantime, I know there are people like you, there are others that are doing a lot of conference presentations, you know, state. I know that at ACFL there were some about, you know, neurodiversity, a lot of just about different learning exceptionalities. You know, I think there is some more resources than I remember in the past, you know, now becoming, you know, available. And so we will, in the show notes, put some of the information that we can have. We'll put something on UDL and we'll put some resources that can kind of help, you know, teachers, no matter where you are. If you're not in a state that does have some resources for world languages, they are out there, you know, in other places that we can access. So any final thoughts
great.
Or notes that you'd like to add before we log off?
Just that, to that end, I was at the ACTFL conference in Chicago last weekend, 2 weekends ago, very recently. And I know that there are a number of us, there were more presentations this year than there were last year. And I would expect that next year in Philadelphia, there will be even more still. I know that several of us are working to create a special interest group within ACTFL, which could help support teachers with disabilities. So those things are ongoing. And other regional organizations are increasingly spending time on how we can support our diverse learners, talking about neurodiversity and different learning styles, learning abilities in the classroom, and how we can support all of our students. It is a growing field, and there are a number of us working towards this, and hopefully an increasing number all the way into the future, so that all of our kids have access to language learning.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. And we will put in the show notes, I don't know if this, hopefully this will air before your winter workshop with MAFLA. So we'll put that information there as well. And thank you so much,
Danya. Oh, that would be great. I'd love that.
Yeah, we want to, absolutely. And so it has been just a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for coming on and spending a couple hours with me total to talk about this really important issue. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a great afternoon.